Hello and welcome to the Majlis podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. Since Islamic State became a major factor in Syria and Iraq, along tens of thousands of militants, thousands of Central Asian fighters also gone to Syria to join the group. Like their numbers, their motivations, though, remains open for interpretation. But regardless, the pressing question of the day is, as IS's own short-lived so-called caliphate crumbling, what are the options for those Central Asian militants going forward? This is the Majlis's topic for this episode. To discuss the subject, from Bishkek, we are joined by Pezhemislav Ozirsky, who is the Deputy Director of Central Asia Strategic Study Center for Analysis, Dialogue and Development. From Washington, D.C., we are joined by Dr. Aykan Erdemir and Merve Tahiroglu, who are researchers at the Foundation for Defense in Democracies, and Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, called Kishlak Owozi, is joining us from Prague. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome on board.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Very nice to have you. So the biggest question of the day is, now IS as a group fighting for its own survival, they are no more advancing in Syria and Iraq. Perhaps their strongholds are crumbling. In situation like this, especially talking about Central Asian militants, what is next for them? Maybe we can start with you, Aykan.
Central Asian fighters have proven themselves to be pretty flexible, pretty resourceful. They have switched allegiances between Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups and the Islamic State. They have traveled in and out of Turkey. They have grafted onto other fighters from Uyghur-dominated, Chechen-dominated, Russian-speaker-dominated groups, which shows that they have the cultural capital. They have the battlefield experience. They have built new networks. They have become further radicalized through their experience in Syria. So at this point, now that the Islamic State is crumbling, they will tap into these new networks, these new experiences. And they, since they have proven that they're quite flexible, they do have a couple of options ahead of them, which we might discuss later today. But just to name a few, they have a strong foothold in Turkey, so Turkey might be a viable option. Return to Central Asia is another option. Return to Afghanistan and Pakistan, maybe temporarily, to set up enclaves could be an option. But I think the more important question could be, could any of these be stepping stones, especially could Turkey be a stepping stone to further travel to either Europe or Russia itself?
Interesting. Maybe we can expand on that. You mentioned Turkey as one of the possible options. It's important in a sense that in first place, they used Turkey as a transit hub on their way to Syria. Merve, maybe you would like to jump in here. Tell us, please, what we mean when we say that Turkey as a potential option for survival for them in the future.
I would like to contextualize this with Turkey serving as a transit point over the last 5 years for several jihadi elements coming from Central Asia, but also from the Caucasus, Europe, mostly from Europe and from other parts of the Middle East and North Africa. The difference between, I guess, the more Europeans who are trying to foreign fighters and the Middle Eastern foreign fighters that are going through Turkey, as opposed to the Central Asians, is that the Central Asians have a much more of a cultural affinity, and they can blend in more easily in Turkish neighborhoods and neighborhoods in Istanbul. Among, you know, we have stronger Uyghur communities and where usually is that we call them Uyghur communities in Turkey, but really it's not just Uyghurs that are there, but also we have other Central Asians from Tajikistan, from Uzbekistan, etc. And so I think this idea of them having more cultural affinity than, let's say, the Syrian refugees who are coming in or the, you know, North African European migrants who are coming in has allowed them to blend in more easily among Turkish communities. And I think that is the reason why ISIS, in its attacks against Turkey, has over the last 2 years switched from using local local Turkish networks into these Central Asian foreign fighters inside Turkey because they have been less suspicious and the government was not monitoring them, or security authorities were not monitoring them as heavily as they did these other foreign fighters. We believe that that is, security analysts at least say that perception has changed, that Turkey is now taking this issue more seriously and paying more attention to the movement of Central Asians that are coming in and out of Turkey, considering the potential risk of them coming to Turkey to execute any plans or attacks on behalf of ISIS or various jihadi groups. But I would still say that it's going to be much easier for Central Asians to come to have a stronghold in Turkey compared to some of their other ethnic counterparts.
Interesting. To stay in the region, Aykan, earlier you also mentioned this. What are the chances of they staying within Syria or Iraq in post-IS atmosphere?
Now, there are some analysts who argue that for many of the Central Asian fighters, especially, you know, Russian speakers who were employed in these low-end jobs in Russia, they see this as a one-way trip, meaning this was to them the possibility of a new beginning. They were either escaping, you know, exploitative jobs or ill treatment in Russia, or they were escaping repressive governments in Central Asia, and they never intended to return. Hmm. Now, for those who will fight it to the bitter end, yes, Iraq and Syria could be an option. But for those who are a little more pragmatic about it, who are more instrumental about this whole journey, they might reinvent themselves in Turkey, because there is one big difference between Turkey and Central Asian republics. In Istanbul, for example, in one of the sub-provinces called Zeytinburnu, there is a sizable Uyghur and Central Asian and Chechen community, and it provides a welcoming ecosystem. You know, you can find employment, you can find shelter, you can blend into solidarity networks, and moreover, you can even change track. You can change from kind of violent jihadism into nonviolent Islamism. There are different Salafi groups or there are different Islamist groups that would welcome you, and you can continue your Islamist activism zeal together with setting up a new life, a new career, a new identity there. Now, this is in stark contrast to the Central Asian republics, where, first of all, any foreign fighter returning is suspect, could be immediately arrested. You know, I talked to a Central Asian official this week who said, you know, we know that, you know, the visa-free travel to Turkey is for 1 month. He said any of our citizens who come back beyond that 1 month stay abroad is suspect and could be part of an kind of interrogation or a detainment. So because there is lack of either incorporative policies back in Central Asia or kind of reintegration and de-radicalization policies back in Central Asia, I think it would always be more favorable from the Central Asian fighters' point of view to pick Turkey. Now, for the zealots who want really to continue to fight, sure, Afghanistan and Pakistan could be new battlefields. And building on top of that, they could ultimately have a kind of a long-term perspective on toppling what they see as the weakest links of the Central Asian republics. So that too is a possibility for the radical extreme. But I think for the mainstream, Turkey remains a very popular and possible destination.
Okay. So you touched upon two other directions. One is Pakistan and Afghanistan is a possible option. The other, Central Asia. Let's start from Central Asia, Pajimislav. So what about going back to their own countries in Central Asia? Is that an option looking from Bishkek towards Syria?
Of course, I would agree that there are certain policies of security from the security sector that those people returning from Syria, they are filtered on the border. Mm-hmm. So yes, jail is one option that those people go. And I could say that even like if we take the official statistics, for example, from the Osh region, so we'll have like 454 people actually that went to Syria, 31 people returned. Of them, like 22 were jailed. Yes, so and still the 9 of them, they are free and they leave. but still they are monitored. So you would be jailed, but you'll be jailed for 2 years or more. It's very difficult to prove those people that they were engaged in fight, actually. Huh. And still, there is another issue that those people returning from Syria, they are not accepted within their societies.
Huh.
So it's not only about the states. There are cases that people were stopped on the Turkish-Syrian border, huh, returned to Kyrgyzstan, to their village, and the locals called authorities to resettle them. That people don't want to leave, actually, with people returning. They are seen here as in Kyrgyzstan sometimes by local population as threat. So it's even more complicated. So I would agree that it could be easier for them to stay in Turkey.
Okay, so Bruce, so the treatment of those returnees looks varies, from country to country in Central Asia. This was the picture from Kyrgyzstan. What about the other Central Asian countries, like especially Uzbekistan and Tajikistan?
You know, of course, the Uzbek security forces are checking just about anyone that comes back to the country from wherever they've been. The airports be absolutely impossible, but even trains and buses are being checked all the time, too. And they want to know a lot about where these people have been and, what they were doing there. We know also that Uzbek SNB is working closely with some of the other intelligence organizations, the FSB, for instance, in Russia, so that they can monitor their own migrant laborers when they're in Russia. So, I as far as like getting into Uzbekistan or Turkmenistan would be even harder. It would be really, really difficult to get into Uzbekistan right now, given the kind of paranoia that exists within the security structures there and the measures that they've already put into place to screen everyone that's coming back into the country. I mean, you hear these stories about people that they've been out of the country for a couple months or something like that, and they take their phones and check and see everything that's on them, and their computers if they have those, and check and see everything that's on them, before they can even get out of the airport or the train station. So it would be tough, Now that said, it's possible that I suppose they could get into another country. If you can get into Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan, then there's probably places along the border where you could cross if you were just dead set on getting into the country. The way they monitor the population in Uzbekistan, it wouldn't probably be so long before they were aware of the fact that you had entered the country and after having been gone for some time, and there would be a lot of questions raised about, not just to that particular person, but among the families and friends about who these people were, where they were, what they were doing, and a lot of checks on what was happening when they were while they were away to the best extent possible. So I would think, certainly in the Uzbek case and the Turkmen case, they probably have enough checks in place that I can't see that this would be a major problem for either one of those two countries.
Oh, about the other option, going to Afghanistan from Syria, probably it will happen through Turkey and Iran. If they manage that, they will be certainly welcomed by Central Asian militants who are already present there. But is it a viable option? Is it possible to cross all these borders and end up in Afghanistan? Who wants to take this question? Maybe I can't, Bruce?
Let me start on this.
Yeah.
Now, recent developments in Afghanistan, that is Vice President Dostum's quote-unquote escape to Turkey, under dubious circumstances, and the rumors that he might not return, might lead to a certain power vacuum, especially in the Uzbek-dominated areas. So I think this could be attractive, not only for Uzbek jihadis, but also other Central Asian fighters, to exploit this vacuum and to kind of build on the existing network in Afghanistan to establish several well-entrenched enclaves, which could be a new kind of ISIS-dominated region in Afghanistan. And this is not only attractive just for the Afghan battlefield, but also this could be attractive as a stepping stone, as kind of a launch pad for the next assault on some of the Central Asian republics. Because there are rumors that some of the Central Asian fighters now have their eyes on Central Asian states. We know that there are deficiencies in governance, there are grievances, there is a relatively weak state apparatus in some of these countries. And this is basically yet another reason why Central Asian fighters have their eye on these countries. So I think we might see a certain number of Central Asian fighters exploiting channels through Turkey and Iran to and maybe Pakistan to finally make it to Afghanistan. Of course, there is always the question. It's not necessarily Western counterterrorism effort, but it might be competition from other Islamists in Afghanistan that could slow this down or hinder this. That is, we know that the Taliban is not necessarily on good terms with what the Islamic State is trying to do in Afghanistan. Some of the earlier Central Asian jihadis were basically eliminated, again, not by Western counterterrorism efforts, but by Taliban efforts. So we might see kind of intra-jihadi fighting there. We might see this slowing down Central Asian fighter flows to Afghanistan. But at the same time, I think the demographics is there, meaning there, there is a base on which they can build a new project in Afghanistan, and there are prospects for further action in the neighborhood.
Bruce, we have seen reports that Central Asians arrested in Afghan-Iran border or Iran-Pakistan border from our own language services, several of such reports in the last days. Are we seeing this journey is already taking place?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have reports, as you mentioned, in our services that show that some of the people who were fighting in Syria and Iraq have started to drift back into Afghanistan. You know, with any of these groups, one of the first things they want to do is set up a network that, that can transport new recruits into their ranks. This has been going on, you know, for years and years, even when the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan was in, you know, active in Afghanistan, that they figured out ways that they could get their people from wherever country they were into Afghanistan or the Pakistani tribal areas. So there's certainly a network that's there, and one would expect that it would be developing as time goes on, because there's going to be more of these people. You know, like Icon said, there's going to be people that are hardcore, you know, extremists at this point, and they really have nothing. If they're going to be ejected, they're losing in Iraq and Syria, and they want to continue the fight, then they're going to have to find a new theater to do that in. Afghanistan is one that presents probably the best opportunities for them, because they do have their ethnic kin, cousins, at least their own people are up there in the north. So if you're an Uzbek and you're trapped in Iraq and Syria, and one of the groups in Afghanistan can get you back in there and get up to North Afghanistan, then that's probably looks like a pretty good option for you, because then you're back in among your own people, more or less. So I would expect that's, you know, that will continue. As we've seen, it's already started. It was a trickle now, but I suppose the closer we get to the fall of Mosul and Raqqa and places like that, you probably see more of these people trying to return. It's a big question about who they're going to return to. You know, as we know, there's been Uzbek fighters, for instance, who came out of the tribal areas, and some of them went and fought with on the side of ISIS, and some of them fought with different jihadi groups that were fighting against ISIS in Syria and Iraq. So I would imagine they would just add to the confusion in northern Afghanistan. But then again, a confusing situation is where groups like this thrive, so it's a natural draw for them.
Thank you very much, Bruce Panier. Either IS remains as an effective force or fell apart in the Middle East. These militants in Syria and Iraq are indeed remain a wild threat. Also poses a humanitarian challenge of some sort, because a number of them went to Syria with their kids and families, and most of them have nowhere to go. Talking about the Central Asian militants, part of the solution might also lie in the fact that who they are and what they have been doing while in Syria, in Iraq. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like the Majlis podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Gandhara Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Pakistan and Afghanistan from local perspective. And the podcast is published in every second week on Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis RFRL Central Asia podcast. We are discussing future of Central Asian militants who joined IS in Syria and Iraq and their options of survival going forward. Joining me in the discussion are Przemyslaw Ozirski, the Deputy Director of Central Asia Strategic Center for Analysis, Dialogue and Development, Dr. Aykan Erdemir, former Turkish parliamentarian and scholar. He's currently a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense and Democracy Democracies, Merve Tahiroglu, Turkish affairs researcher with the same think tank as Dr. Erdemir is, with an eye on foreign militants in Syria, Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberties, Central Asia blog called Kishlok Owozi is joining us from Prague. Merve, you've been quiet today, so let's start with you. Earlier in our private discussion, we have been talking about the role that the Central Asian militants are playing in Syria and Iraq. Can you please share your thoughts on what they were up to while in Syria?
At least I've seen them only active in the Islamic State, which is, as you know, the more hardline of all the jihadi groups in Syria. Now, it's a misconception to think that the Central Asians make a large part of ISIS fighting force. In fact, they don't. Their numbers are believed to be somewhere between 2,000 and 4,000 at most. However, they are called, security analysts refer to them as some sort of a special forces unit of ISIS, which is, the deadliest and units of ISIS combat units and the ones that are sent for foreign operations, for suicide bombings or some of the big scale mass attacks as they have done in the airports in Brussels or the airports in Istanbul last year. So those types of attacks. So they are said to make a small but very important, crucial part of ISIS's fighting force, which is an important question as to what they would be doing after, what's next after ISIS, because when you see most of ISIS is made up of foreign fighters. And when I say foreign fighters, I mean fighters that are foreign to Syria and Iraq. So a lot of them are going to have to be ejected, regardless of from their established communities in Syria and Iraq once this fight is over, once ISIS is defeated, and perhaps they might try to join these other jihadi groups. And I think that would be a very interesting question as to which one of these could then absorb the Central Asian fighters and what role would they play within those. But for me, what that says, when we look at the fact that the Central Asian fighters are more resilient, are more resourceful, are able to take some of the more daunting tasks that other ISIS fighters either fail at or aren't willing or aren't courageous enough to, play a role in. I think what kind of a question that raises for me is about de-radicalization. And so if the Central Asian fighters are in fact joining these groups, not necessarily only for financial reasons, but if it's primarily for ideological reasons, and if this is the main motivation, then what does that mean for de-radicalization efforts? Let's say if they return to Turkey or try to go, if they don't go into another conflict zone, how will they be able to get integrated into normal, regular life in wherever they end up? And I think that's a major question, considering the kinds of tasks that they're assigned and what that means for them personally and psychologically.
Mm-hmm. Mirva, when you say resilient, when you describe the Central Asian fighters in Syria, what does it mean?
So it just means, the way we see it, the ones that are more willing to take these tasks, such as, because these could be, so ISIS has, and these groups have people, operatives that take various tasks, right? So you see the financiers, which are a different task, the treasurers, and those are the ones, those elements are the ones that are mostly focused on funding for the group. They're not necessarily taking combat roles, and they're not necessarily the ones that are sent out to carry suicide bombing attacks or mass shooting attacks. So when you look at those units, we see that the Central Asian fighters are the ones, at least, especially in the case for Turkey, the Central Asian fighters are the ones that are sent to these kinds of attacks, like the one we saw last June in Istanbul's Atatürk airport. It was a very well-planned attack, but it was also, Istanbul's Atatürk Airport is one of the most secure buildings in Turkey. So to carry out an attack like that requires a lot of zeal, right? It could be, even if the motivation is only financial, I don't think that that's enough. So that's what I mean by resilient. That's what I mean by more willing to take these kinds of tasks. So when we see that kind of an attack happen, that requires some sort of resolve, mental resolve, that not all ISIS fighters have. that.
Let's bring in Pechmislav, you here. The way Merve described the Central Asian fighters, that resilient, resourceful, and ready to take up any challenge, the toughest of attacks. How do you read this from Central Asia? What does it say to you?
Okay, still there is a problem to generalize, to make like general profile of people going from Central Asia to join, let's say, fighting in Syria. Yes, we could, let's say, elaborate, we could speculate that and make the profile, the young man, 20, 30 years old, married with children, yes? But there are people that are very poor, and also the people that are quite rich, I would say, that join. So still, what is the push factor, let's say, to join Islamic State or another, let's say, terrorist or extremist group in Syria? It's difficult to establish. Yes, some of them, they are motivated by religious issues. Some of them, they're just looking for adventure, I would say. And if they are more, let's say, determined to conduct, let's say, suicide actions or some, let's say, more sophisticated operation like in Istanbul airport, I would say maybe they are more determined because they cannot return. Maybe they are much more vulnerable and they are used by Islamic States somehow. Interesting. for such operations. So it's not always their will to conduct. Many of them, they are recruited and they don't know where they're actually going and what they're actually going to do. Sometimes they're going to earn money, sometimes they're religiously motivated, but they see the reality on the ground, and some of them want to return. Sometimes there is the problem they cannot return sometimes. Sometimes the people would return, go to jail, and then return to the normal life, but they cannot. So I would not really like say that they are more eager to conduct some kind of operation. So I would disagree with at this moment.
In Syria, there is no safeguard for them to protect themselves. But a person who is in Istanbul, what makes him vulnerable to do that, such kind of attack against his will?
Many of them, actually, there is, let's say, like 600, 800, let's say, citizen of Kyrgyzstan going to Syria. Many of them actually manage to bring their families to Syria sometimes. And we cannot exclude that some of them, they need to go for such operation because their families, like in Islamic States, is also the families could be seen as kind of, let's say, hostages for those people, I would say, even. Okay, maybe.
Okay. Bruce, this is the picture in Syria, in Iraq, involving Central Asians. What's being told about them in the region?
Well, we know that the governments there have had a campaign against them, for the propaganda campaign. They're even on TV, you see all the time, you know, them warning people against joining these kind of groups. Every now and then they get someone who did return or was handed over from another country, and they try to put them on TV to describe how horrible it was for them personally to be there and how much they regret having gone. You know, the imams at the mosques are all warning the locals about joining these groups or having anything to do with them at all. So, you know, I mean, the governments have done pretty much what they can. They're pretty much in a situation now where they just have to react to these kind of things. Although that said, I really don't see that, certainly short term, this is going to be a huge problem for them. Not so much as people like actually trying to return into Central Asia. If some of these people can get into border areas in northern Afghanistan or something, then it might be a little bit more difficult for the Central Asians. We know, for instance, drug trafficking, that you can't keep everybody out. There's routes into Central Asia for, you know, small groups of people, a couple of people at a time or something like that. But there's, you know, they've done the campaign inside the Central Asian countries. The security forces are watching for these people all the time. They encourage citizens routinely to report any suspicious activity or anybody they think might be involved with this. And I mean, you've even had cases of family members turning over people or contacting the authorities and said they're worried about their brother, their cousin, something like that, and what he's doing. You know, I suppose that said, probably the biggest problem that they're going to have for returning people is some of the people that were migrant laborers in Russia that managed to get away and get down in there. If they can get back into Russia and resume their lives as a migrant laborer, because of course the FSB can't watch everybody, and we know Central Asian migrant laborers are strung across Russia from Vladivostok in the east all the way to Moscow and St. Petersburg, possibly some of those people might be able to get back in if they stayed in Russia for a few months. But you know, again, the Central Asian governments have been paranoid about this for a long, long time. They're watching for them. and it would be difficult for anyone to actually get into the country any way that I can imagine, except for crossing the southern borders, you know, coming out of northern Afghanistan and, you know, as something of a sleeper cell or something like that in Central Asia. But that's the only way I could see it happening.
Mm-hmm. Going back, Pajmislav, regardless of their number and motivations, and I know you have some disagreement with the other opinions, that the hundreds and thousands of Central Asians in fact went to the Middle East and joined these, you know, militant groups. Some of them committed some of the haunting attacks. So did Central Asian authorities learn any lesson from this? If they did, what is that?
First of all, there are new policies, I would say, in religious affairs. There is work with local religious leaders. There are some steps of the state to control mosques, to control madrasas, to issue authorization, to control, let's say, missionary work, dawat in Kyrgyzstan. So the work is ongoing, I would say. There's much more work during the last year. It's actually, we could see some changes in the state policies. But still, there is much work to do, I would say. Let's say with the prevention of radicalization of the people, the work is being conducted. So it's not that the state is waiting. The state is trying to do something. People that are returning, they are monitored. There is huge distrust of the society for those people that are returning back. I would say that the Islamic State, but we have the other groups, also the people that were fighting for the, let's say, other groups in Syria, they much more willing to get back to Kyrgyzstan.
Can I just jump in here real quick?
Sure.
and point out that the states have different policies toward some of these people too. For instance, Tajikistan does have a policy where if you're willing to admit that you were out there fighting, repent for all the stuff you've done, the government will actually try to bring you back. Obviously, you're going to be under suspicion for a long time, you know, and Kyrgyzstan is a little more lenient, too. If you come back and you say you're sorry, maybe you do a little bit of jail time and you'll be watched there, too. But Uzbekistan, for instance, just doesn't want these people to come back at all. And neither does Turkmenistan, so their policies are very, very rigid. If you come back and they believe that you were out there fighting, you're going to prison and for a long, long time.
Unfortunately, we have to conclude the discussion, but let's do that with thoughts from you, Aykan and Mirva. So what can the authorities in Central Asia do to help in solution of this problem?
I think both for Central Asia and also for Turkey, the key challenge appears to be integration policies, de-radicalization policies, because often what makes a big difference in where these Central Asian fighters end up is how they're received. For example, we know from the Turkish experience that the government lacks kind of multicultural, multi-faith, multilingual integration policies. We have seen it with Turkey's own Kurdish citizens. We have seen it with the 3 million Syrian refugees. And we're also seeing it with Central Asians. You know, despite the cultural affinities to Central Asians, to Uyghurs, to Chechens, we see that in Istanbul, there's almost a ghettoization of these individuals, which shows that they're not necessarily excluded, but also they're not necessarily fully integrated. Uh-huh. I think the same also applies for Central Asia, but within a different framework. That is, are there opportunities, are there programs, are there processes through which these individuals and their families are reincorporated, de-radicalized, and retrained for a new life beyond, you know, violence and radicalism. And this ultimately means building state capacity. This means building inclusive institutions and processes, and more importantly, an ethos. And that's is the question of values, commitment to kind of more open, democratic, you know, pro-human rights values.
Okay. Mirva, briefly, please.
Yes, I mean, I absolutely agree. I think for the ones that are already in the region, already fighting, as I explained, I think this is primarily an ideological motivation for joining, because any fighter who's going to ISIS knows what they're doing, knows what they're joining. They are aware of what they're about to do, and they're committing to that. And that is why I think the next step for these fighters is going to be to go to the next conflict zone and then to the next conflict zone. And this is a movement. So what I think what the republics need to do is to try to get the ones that are out to want to come back and use some sort of rehabilitation program to reintegrate them into society. And the sense to have to bring people back into a lawful way of living as opposed to living outside of the law is the key part. And for that, people need to have trust in the justice system around them. And I think that's the key part. So to maintain a sort of rule of law is, I think, would go the longest way to both helping de-radicalization and also allowing for people to not to already be more integrated into society in the first place, to not want to leave and go join these foreign fights.
Okay. Thank you very much for your insightful comments, Merve Tahiroğlu, Turkish Affairs Researcher at the Foundation for Defense in Democracies, Przemyslaw Ozirski, the Deputy Director of the Central Asia Strategic Center for Analysis, Dialogue and Development, Dr. Aykan Erdemir, Senior Turkish Affairs Fellow at the Foundation for Defense in Democracies, Bruce Pioneer, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog called Kishlak Owazi. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you.
And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.